This is now talk number 47 in the series on the wicked, and we're carrying on looking at the broad theme of imprecation or imprecatory prayer. So let's look now at Psalm 109, an interesting psalm, and in this King David sets out a long and blood-curdling curse against the wicked people who oppose and attack him. And so Psalm 109 is one of the more robust of David's imprecatory psalms, and interestingly the heading above it in the Revised Standard Version of the Bible is a psalm of anathema, and that means that what that means is a psalm of cursing. And probably the word anathema has been chosen, I don't know this, but perhaps it is chosen by the RSV translators precisely in order not to upset those people who are uneasy about or opposed to the concept of cursing anybody. Maybe that's why they used the little known word anathema, which means curse. But even I find parts of this psalm surprising in terms of the severity of David's request, not only about the wicked themselves, but about their wives and their families as well. But nevertheless, the fact is that it's in the Bible, and we've got to deal with it. And it's how King David often prayed, and there's no getting away from it. But do also bear in mind, however, that from David's perspective, and also from Israel's perspective, the children of the wicked were very likely to become wicked themselves. That's the whole point about the Canaanites in the beginning, that even their children would soon become enemies to Israel. And therefore, within 10 years or so, the children that we're speaking of here would become the next generation of adult enemies with whom David would have to contend. So if you see it in that context, and also given that David and his line had got the throne permanently, it actually makes sense for him to think of the long term, not just the present, not just dealing with the wicked who are there now, but the wicked who are soon going to be there. So let's look closely at verses 1 to 20 of Psalm 109, but especially verses 10 to 13. And as we go through this, look how explicit David is. And note also that this passage contains a variety of different approaches to imprecation. So David uses imprecatory prayer, in which he asks God to do things, but he also makes proclamations and declarations of what he believes will occur. But he also makes a number of direct curses of his own, in which he speaks curses over his enemies and invokes a dreadful outcome for them. And so he speaks it over them, he wills it upon them, and he seeks to cause it by his own cursing words. So here goes from verse 1. "Be not silent, O God of my praise, for wicked and deceitful mouths are opened against me, speaking against me with lying tongues. They beset me with words of hate and attack me without cause. In return for my love they accuse me, even as I make prayer for them. So they reward me evil for good and hatred for my love. Appoint a wicked man against him. Let an accuser bring him to trial. When he is tried, let him come forth guilty. Let his prayer be counted as sin. May his days be few. May another seize his goods. May his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. May his children wander about and beg. May they be driven out of the ruins they inhabit. May the creditor seize all that he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his toil. Let there be none to extend kindness to him, nor any to pity his fatherless children. May his posterity be cut off. May his name be blotted out in the second generation. May the iniquity of his fathers be remembered before the Lord, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Let them be before the Lord continually, and may his memory be cut off from the earth. For he did not remember to show kindness, but pursued the poor and needy and the brokenhearted to their death. He loved to curse, let curses come on him. He did not like blessing, may it be far from him. He clothed himself with cursing as his coat. May it soak into his body like water, like oil into his bones. May it be like a garment which he wraps round him, like a belt with which he daily girds himself. May this be the reward of my accusers from the Lord, of those who speak evil against my life. Now, that's pretty spectacular stuff, isn't it? And especially when you look at what he's saying about the children of the wicked, and the direct things that he has to say about them, and also the way in which he speaks so directly about cursing the wicked. Alright, so that psalm presents a difficulty, in a sense, even for the advocates of imprecatory prayer, because it goes further than I personally would ever have ever found myself going and would ever want to go, unless I was in extreme circumstances. But then the fact is that King David spent much of his life in extreme circumstances. He faced wars, rebellions, attempts on his life, plots, lies, slanders and curses, and he also had to spend years on the run with people hunting him or seeking to betray him to those who would kill him. So if I was in some of the harrowing situations that David had to deal with, I think I would possibly be willing to pray such a prayer. And so, but bear in mind also that what David was praying for in verses 10 to 13 of Psalm 109 is actually a great deal less severe than what the British and American air forces actually were doing to Germany in the strategic bombing campaign of 1941 to 45. And the bombs that we dropped relentlessly, night and day, they were not only aimed at German industry, dockyards and railways, but also at German cities. And we took the view that until we were strong enough to actually invade France, which wasn't until June 1944, the only major offensive action of which we were realistically capable was the aerial bombing of Germany, which was very imprecise. We couldn't pinpoint bombs on particular buildings. All we could do is aim at cities and just hope to hit some of the city. And nevertheless, I believe personally that we were entirely right to bomb Germany, including their civilian population, because their entire nation was one huge war-making machine, the whole lot of them together. And if we couldn't hit all of their railways and depots and factories, we could at least hit their houses, and that would render the factory workers homeless and reduce the efficiency and industrial capacity of Germany, which it did. Towards the end of the war, the German army and air force in particular were running out of material, running out of oil, running out of spare parts, running out of weapons, running out of everything. And that was because of the strategic bombing campaign. And so it was necessary and justified because those factory workers were just as much a threat to our troops as the German soldiers and sailors and airmen were. So therefore, David wasn't praying for anything that was worse than or even equal to what we inflicted on Germany. So you look at it in those terms, all of a sudden David's actions don't seem so strange at all. But anyone who wants to criticize King David should also bear in mind that what we did to Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, and they were both obliterated by atomic bombs, and that includes all the children and women who were in those cities. But also Tokyo was almost equally destroyed by conventional bombs and incendiaries. And we used those to create a firestorm which destroyed nearly the whole of Tokyo. And we, the Allies, we were prepared, and I think rightly, in my view, to destroy those cities ourselves. Not through God, but us doing it ourselves. And to destroy the men and the women and the children who lived in those cities, many of whom were innocent bystanders. So that's what we did, and would even to this day say that we were right to do. So therefore, why would David be wrong to ask God to bring about the same effect on a far smaller scale, and to ask for it solely amongst the families of the wicked, not the innocent? And we bombed everybody, the wicked and the innocent, together. That's what we did. because we had no alternative. If you're going to bomb Germany, you can't decide which houses you're going to hit and which houses you're not going to hit. You'd be lucky even to hit the city, never mind a particular part of it. We just had to blanket bomb the cities as a whole, sending over 1,000 bombers in a single raid. And that's the way we did it. It was the only way we could do it. So I think I labour all of that because we need to just look at what David was doing and be more understanding of what he was saying. Because I think sometimes we judge other people and criticise what they do without having regard to what we do. So we might condemn David for doing something which we do on an even bigger scale. Okay, well, let's look at the difference between asking God to curse a person or a group and directly cursing them yourself. So, the very suggestion of praying against a person and asking God to oppose them or remove them, etc., it's hard enough, that's hard enough for most of us to accept, and it seems alien and improper. And the fact that it's not done in the vast majority of churches strengthens the impression that there must be something wrong with it. And even more people, however, would recoil from the idea of a Christian himself directly cursing a person or a group. That seems even more beyond the pale, even more unthinkable to many people. But the problem is that both of those things, prayer, imprecatory prayer that's asking God to do something, and imprecatory statements and proclamations by the person themselves, both of those things are done by major figures in the Bible, including Paul, Apostle Paul. So, leaving aside the validity or otherwise of this, let's try to distinguish between these two methods more clearly. And that'll help us to see when it might be more appropriate to ask God to oppose or curse the person or group, and in what sort of circumstances we should do it ourselves. So, just as an analogy, imagine what happens when artillery is used in warfare. Now, artillery is the very big guns, not that you hold in your hands, but which are on the ground, and they fire shells. They fire explosive shells onto enemy positions. Now, consider how artillery is used and by whom it's used and how it's directed onto its intended targets, because the soldiers using it can do one of two things. Firstly, they can fire the heavy guns themselves, and this is like what happens when a person curses something or someone themselves. They themselves are doing the actual firing. But the alternative, the second alternative, is that a soldier can just request support from those who fire the artillery. So an infantryman could be in a forward position and can give map references and coordinates or even laser guidance nowadays, and this can be done from a forward position by him sending information back to those who are firing the artillery, so he can see the target and he can radio back to them to tell them where to aim. And so he radios in and he tells those who are doing the firing where the enemy is located and who he wants them to fire at. So the main approach taken in the Bible would broadly correspond to the second option. That's option B, the second option there I've just mentioned. That's the most usual approach, which involves us asking God to fire the artillery at the enemy, as it were. And then the person who's engaging in imprecatory prayer isn't firing any weapon himself. He's asking God to do so. Nevertheless, they're still involved, heavily involved, and they fully intend for God to open fire on that enemy. And yet, nevertheless, there's no getting away from the fact that at certain times, David and Moses and Paul and others also engaged in the first option, whereby they fire the heavy guns themselves. And so that is, it's as if those were Moses and David and Paul and so on, were firing the artillery themselves by directly cursing a person or a group, rather than by simply asking God to do it for them. So I accept that that's the less used of the two approaches. Most of the time people are asking God to do it, but nevertheless it is still used by figures in the Bible, and I believe that there are times when we are meant to do so as well, not just them, us as well. And that is, there are certain times when God not only permits us, but actually wants us to fire the artillery ourselves by directly cursing someone or something. And so, an example I can give of when I've engaged in such direct imprecation or cursing involved two former business partners of mine. I've spoken of them on other tapes, on other discs in the past. Now, they acted wrongly towards me, in my opinion, and expelled me from a law firm in which I had a one-third equity stake, and they did so because I'd caught one of the partners forging an invoice on the firm's letterhead, and I confronted him about it. And the other partner, the senior partner, he initially promised to support me, but he then changed sides a day or two later, and he was totally silent when I raised this misconduct at a partners meeting. And the end result of it was that the two of them joined together to drive me out of that firm for having raised this issue, and they then refused to pay me my one-third share of the equity value. And that was very painful, very difficult for me, and in particular because it was impossible for me both to sue them, which would have been very costly, and at the same time also to set up a new law firm of my own, because I hadn't got the money or the time to do both of those things. So I reluctantly had to choose, in the end, not to sue them, but just to focus all my time and energy and money on setting up my own new law firm. So instead of suing them, I just prayed for God to judge between us, for God to grant me justice and to bring his judgment upon them for what they'd done, if he considered it to be wrong. And I proclaimed Psalm 35 in relation to my two former business partners. And in that psalm, which I've quoted from earlier, David asks God to contend with his enemies and to fight against them. And as time went by, at a later point, I actually felt that God wanted me to go even further than that, and that he wanted me to be involved in the judgment that he was going to bring upon them. And to begin with, I believe that God spoke to me through the advice that was given to me by a friend of mine called Bob. And he was older than me and far more knowledgeable about imprecatory prayer at the time. And Bob told me the difference between asking God to bring judgment on these two men and me myself speaking over them by myself as an imprecatory declaration by me. And he explained it to me. And when he did, an analogy came to my mind of me lighting the blue touch paper, as you do when you're lighting fireworks. And I felt, the impression that came to my mind was that God was actually waiting for me to light the blue touch paper before he would move against them in judgment, that he wanted to work in conjunction with me, which indeed is how God operates continually. That's how he's always operating. He wants to do things with us, not just do everything himself. So I felt God was waiting on me to invoke his judgment on them, to call upon his judgment. And I felt God wanted me to be part of that. So I believe God wanted me to speak the judgment over them, as it were, in the way that Ezekiel was told to prophesy judgment over various groups and nations. And I felt unsure about this, whether I was right in thinking I should do this. This is the thought that was coming to me, kept coming to me. So I told Bob about it, and he said it sounded absolutely right to him and that I should go ahead and do that. But note how cautious I was about all of this. I had been treated very, very badly by them, and my former partners had taken all my assets and basically seized them and refused to hand them back when they should have done. And yet, I wasn't rushing even into imprecatory prayer as a form of request, let alone into directly proclaiming against them or cursing them myself. In fact, on the contrary, I had to be persuaded to be willing to do it, and I entered into it slowly and reluctantly. And yet I believe it was the right thing to do. And from the point when I lit the blue touch paper, as you might say, and spoke God's judgment over them, a series of events then started to happen, which went on for over 10 years. And their firm, the one I had left, it declined, it lost staff, and it got into one problem after another, including trouble with regulatory authorities. But I, on the other hand, went from strength to strength, and within 5 years of me leaving that firm, my new firm was over 3 times bigger than theirs and vastly more profitable, even though on the day I started it, it was just me. There were no staff or anything. And what's more, when I eventually sold my law firm after 13 years of running it, because I wanted to become a full-time Bible teacher and writer, everything went really well with the sale of that business, and God provided me with the perfect buyer. But the very next year after my sale, and after the start of my new Bible teaching ministry, both of my former business partners were declared bankrupt. And I believe that God's judgment had pursued them throughout those 14 years, and that he was punishing them for what they'd done. And I believe he was responding to my prayers and responding to my declarations and proclamations against them. And in the end, God took everything away from them. Not only what they'd taken from me that belonged to me, but also all of their own assets as well. Now, who could have foreseen that in the natural at the outset? Their business was a successful going concern. I'd helped to build it up. It was doing very well and it was very profitable. And they had all the staff, they had all the files, clients, the premises, the equipment, and a strong cash flow. Everything was just dead easy for them. But in stark contrast, I had nothing at all at day one, starting the new business. I began my new firm with no staff, no clients, no files, no equipment, nothing at all. Zero. And if anyone had said back then that I would end up being successful and they would both end up bankrupt, it would have been considered a ridiculous prediction. In the natural, that would seem impossible. Not only impossible for me to succeed, but pretty much impossible for them to fail. And yet both of those things happened at more or less the same time. And I believe that a large part of the reason for what became of them was my own imprecatory prayer and proclamation. In particular, I believe it was the direct imprecation of my own when I spoke God's judgment over them. I believe God responded to that. Okay, well, let's look at a different aspect of David's imprecatory prayers. Now let's look at some of the things that he said on behalf of Israel. Let's consider some examples of this, which David said specifically on their behalf, on Israel's behalf, rather than his own. Now, whatever you might say about the validity of imprecatory prayer on your own behalf, personal behalf, I believe it's undoubtedly justified when it's done for the benefit of Israel. So let's look at a few. In Psalm 9, verses 19 to 20, it says, "Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the nations be judged before thee. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men." And then Psalm 59, verse 5. "Thou, Lord God of hosts, art God of Israel. Awake to punish all the nations. Spare none of those who treacherously plot evil." And then Psalm 59, 12 to 13 says, "For the sin of their mouths, the words of their lips, let them be trapped in their pride. For the cursing and lies which they utter, consume them in wrath. Consume them till they are no more, that men may know that God rules over Jacob to the ends of the earth." And then Psalm 60, verses 11 and 12. "O grant us help against the foe, for vain is the help of man. With God we shall do valiantly. It is he who will tread down our foes." So those are just some examples of how David spoke on behalf of Israel. But let's look now at a major imprecatory psalm on behalf of Israel, but one which is written by Asaph, not written by King David. Now he's one of the psalmists, and he was a Levite. He wasn't the king of Israel. He was a musician and a worship leader in the tabernacle. We're also told in 1 Chronicles 25 verse 2 that he prophesied under the direction of the king. So that's who Asaph was. But in Psalm 83, he's asking God to expose, to defeat, to destroy, and to put to shame the enemies of Israel and of the Jewish people. And Asaph begins by identifying the main enemies of Israel. That's the Arab nations that are surrounding them. And that was true then, and it's still true today, 3,000 years later. So Psalm 83, 1-8. O God, do not keep silence. Do not hold thy peace or be still, O God. For lo, thy enemies are in tumult. Those who hate thee have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against thy people. They consult together against thy protected ones. They say, Come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more. Yea, they conspire with one accord. Against thee they make a covenant. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gibal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia and the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria also has joined them. They are the strong arm of the children of Lot. Now, Asaph spells out really starkly what he wants God to do to these hostile Arabs who are causing so much trouble for Israel. And he doesn't use any sanitized euphemisms or toned down, watered down, politically correct language covered in sugar and spice. He means business, and he asks God to intervene in drastic ways. And I believe we are entitled to pray in similar ways today against those people and groups who oppose Israel or who oppose the church or who seek world domination. And that would include groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Taliban, and so on. There are so many of them. But also against the very religion of Islam itself. Because we need to be clear in what we say. It's not just these groups that allegedly depart from Islam and misrepresent Islam that are the problem. It's Islam that's the problem. These groups are not misrepresenting Islam. They are correctly, accurately representing it. They are the accurate picture of Islam, of what it really is, not some perversion of Islam. They are real Islam. And so Islam itself, not just these splinter groups as they're alleged to be, but Islam itself is utterly evil and satanic, and it promotes violent jihad. And so look here in Psalm 83 verse 9-17. What Asaph has to say and how direct he is. Verse 9, Do to them as thou didst to Midian, as to Sisera and Jabin at the river Kishon, who were destroyed at Endor, who became dung for the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, Let us take possession for ourselves of the pastures of God. O my God, make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind, as fire consumes the forest, as the flame sets the mountains ablaze. So do thou pursue them with thy tempest, and terrify them with thy hurricane. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek thy name, O Lord. Let them be put to shame and dismayed for ever. Let them perish in disgrace. So you see what I mean? Asaph is straight to the point. He doesn't beat about the bush or mess around. He tells God exactly what he wants in plain terms, in plain words. So, anyway, King David didn't invent imprecatory prayer, and neither did Asaph. Moses also used it many centuries earlier. And we'll give an example of that in a moment. So, on the rare occasions when imprecation is mentioned at all in churches, which is extremely rare, I have to say. Nevertheless, on those very rare occasions, it's usually implied that only King David ever did this, or even that it can only be done by kings, not by ordinary people. But that's not true. It wasn't only David, and it's not only done by kings. David was not the only one to engage in imprecatory prayer or proclamation, and he wasn't even the first. And so, as I said, Moses used it in this prayer below, which is set out in Numbers 10:35. And this is what he said. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, Arise, O Lord, and let thy enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee. So that was the proclamation, the request that Moses made whenever they set out. How warlike that is. How warlike he was in his speech and in his prayers. So We need to examine this practice right across the board and look at some of the different figures in the Bible who prayed like this, and you may be surprised by how numerous they are. So I'm going to give some more, but as I say, it's by no means exhaustive. There are others too. So let's look at King Jehoshaphat, because he used imprecatory prayer on behalf of Judah when it faced military attack by the men of Ammon, Moab and Mount Seir. Now they are Arabs from what we would now call Jordan, to the east of Israel. So when the kingdom of Judah faced attack, King Jehoshaphat, he asked God to intervene, and he asked them to execute judgment upon these attackers, who were what we now call Arabs. And so 2 Chronicles 20 verses 10 to 12, it says, "And now behold, the men of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom thou wouldst not let Israel invade when they came from the land of Egypt, and whom they avoided and did not destroy, behold, they reward us by coming to drive us out of thy possession, which thou hast given us to inherit. O our God, wilt thou not execute judgment upon them? For we are powerless against this great multitude that is coming against us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon thee." Now, that's what Jehoshaphat was saying, but God plainly did not disapprove of that prayer, neither did he refuse to answer it. On the contrary, he actually replied to Jehoshaphat, and the people of Israel, and the people of Judah as well, through a prophetic word which was spoken by Jahaziel. He's one of the sons of Asaph. And God said through him that they would not even need to fight in this battle, because he would fight for them. And it's in 2 Chronicles 20, verses 14 to 17. It says, "And the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jahaziel, the son of Zechariah, son of Benaiah, son of Jehiel, son of Mattaniah, a Levite of the sons of Asaph, in the midst of the assembly. And he said, Hearken, all Judah, and inhabitants of Jerusalem, and King Jehoshaphat. Thus says the Lord to you, Fear not, and be not dismayed at this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow go down against them. Behold, they will come up by the ascent of Ziz, and you will find them at the end of the valley, east of the wilderness of Jeruel. You will not need to fight in this battle. Take your position, stand still, and see the victory of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. Fear not, and be not dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, and the Lord will be with you." Okay, so that's what he was told. But later, God answered the prayer directly by intervening and causing these three Arab armies to turn on each other and to destroy themselves without Judah having to do anything. And so it says in 2 Chronicles 20, verses 22 to 24, "And when they began to sing and praise, the Lord set an ambush against the men of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, who had come against Judah, so that they were routed. For the men of Ammon and Moab rose against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, destroying them utterly. And when they had made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, they all helped to destroy one another. When Judah came to the watchtower of the wilderness, they looked toward the multitude, and behold, they were dead bodies lying on the ground. None had escaped." So let's look at some further imprecatory psalms concerning the enemies of Israel, which are written by people other than King David, just to show that it's not just him. So some other psalmists besides David also wrote imprecatory psalms about the enemies of Israel, or Zion. Because remember, David didn't write all the psalms. He wrote a lot of them, but not all. So in Psalm 129, which is by an unnamed psalmist, it says, "May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward. Let them be like the grass on the housetops, which withers before it grows up." So there we are, a direct imprecatory request for bad things to happen to them. And then likewise in Psalm 79, Asaph makes this imprecatory prayer for God to punish the enemies of Israel, who taunted God. And he says in Psalm 79 verse 12, "Return sevenfold into the lap of our neighbours the taunts with which they have taunted you, O Lord." And then in Psalm 94, another unnamed psalmist makes a powerful imprecatory prayer, and it's also a proclamation against the arrogant nations which seek to crush the Jewish people. It says, Psalm 94:1-7, O Lord, thou God of vengeance, thou God of vengeance, shine forth, rise up, O judge of the earth, render to the proud of their deserts. O Lord, how long shall the wicked exult? They pour out their arrogant words, they boast, all the evildoers. They crush thy people, O Lord, and afflict thy heritage. They slay the widow and the sojourner, and murder the fatherless. And they say, the Lord does not see, the God of Jacob does not perceive. And then in verse 14 it says, For the Lord will not forsake his people, he will not abandon his heritage. And then at the end, later part of Psalm 94, the psalmist concludes by proclaiming that God will wipe them out. And he says, He will bring back on them their iniquity and wipe them out for their wickedness. The Lord our God will wipe them out. Now you see what I mean? How strong that is, how powerful that language is, and how it's not just David that's doing it. Now I believe it was right for David and others to pray for the destruction of those Arab armies, and that it's equally valid for us to do so today, because Israel's enemies are now found in every nation, and yet they are still mainly amongst the Islamic neighbours of Israel, especially the Arabs, and therefore I believe we should also pray for the defeat of Islam itself. That's a perfectly right and proper prayer to make. And very, very few people in the churches, very few church leaders will say that, even privately, let alone openly. But I will say it openly. Islam is an evil abomination. It's created by Satan, and it's committed to destroying Israel and the Jewish people. It's committed to taking over the world by force of arms. That's not the objective of a few splinter groups who are extremist. Those people who are saying that are not extreme. They're just straightforward Muslims who are saying exactly what the Quran says, and they're doing exactly what the Quran tells them to do. Now those facts alone, just those facts, and there are many more things you can say about how terrible Islam is, but just those facts entitle and oblige us to pray against Islam, because it's unambiguously and quite self-evidently evil and wicked to its core, quite apart from the fact that it does many, many other things, including persecuting the church. Okay, well, I'll stop at that point for the end of that talk.